people. Yeah, so although this work don't have arrow, but yeah, so but it's actually related to that unpublished work that Xiaogang mentioned. So yeah, so this is my report of continuation of my PhD study. So today I'm gonna talk about this classification of symmetry-enriched topological faces. So let me first outline my talk. I will start with motivation, and then I discuss the classification and the connections with previous works, and then I try to describe the exact solvable models associated with this classification. So essentially, there's a classification of quantum phase of matter, and for every phase, there's a exact solvable model to realize that phase. So here I try to describe that model, and there's some basic or fundamental math or physics that are related to this exact solvable models. And then I will talk about how to add symmetry to this model and to study how symmetry and the topological order in this model interplay. So including symmetry formalization, and then finally I have some discussion. So there's a because we're a contemporary physicist, so it's always good to have this general picture about what we know about quantum matter physics. So essentially, quantum matter physics really try to understand phases and phase transition in a rather general way. We have a global picture for all possible phases and phase transitions. And in fact, there's a standard model that is very, very successful. So this is a Landau's theory of phase of matter. This includes Landau's Fermi liquid theory for metal and Landau's theory for symmetry breaking phase. So these two pieces of information actually become very useful in solid state and other quantum matter physics. So it did describe a lot of phenomena. So in this standard model, we know phases differ because their symmetry are different. So for example, if you start from a liquid, you cool it down, the liquid form a crystal. And what happens here in terms of this Landau's this standard model point of view is that this crystal phase is a consequence of breaking translational symmetry. And mathematically, the mathematical language to describe this standard model is this symmetry group and the emergent Landau order parameter. For example, in the crystal, we have an order parameter specified by this Bragg peak. So this mathematical language, symmetry group, become very useful because now you not only have a physics picture, you also have some concrete mathematical language. So this allow you to even do something like complete. So for example, for crystals, you can really try to classify all the crystals. There are these 230 possible space groups. So the amazing thing is that actually all these space groups got realized in nature. So there, for every space group, there's a material. So this means, this suggests the classification is useful. Right. So the recent progress in quantum physics point out that maybe we have to look beyond the standard model. In fact, previously we already know violations of the standard model. There are known phases, for example, in one-dimensional systems or 2D electron gas in strong magnetic field. In those physical systems, you really have to go beyond the standard model to have some other way to understand the phase of matter. Suppose I don't look at those extreme conditions. So previously it seems the standard model is still okay, but now it's just probably different. So recently there are a lot of non-Landau phases even in the more or less conventional solids. So For example, there's these topological insulators, there's this material and the quantum spin liquid, there's this candidate material which is very promising called the Kermit spin side. So this experiment progress forced us to look beyond the standard model and to really look into this new pattern of emergence or new type of order that is not described by the Langdon theory. So the issue is the purpose of this talk is mainly try to understand how to systematically describe these new orders and what is the new theoretical framework. You know, standard model represents the standard of a good theory. So the goal, eventual goal, would be, you know, to find some good theory to describe these new orders. So let's have a brief overview about our understanding for gap quantum phases. So the standard model tells us there's at least one way to look at quantum phases, that is gap quantum phases based on symmetry. For example, there are Ising ferromagnet and Ising paramagnet. They differ because they have different symmetry. But then we know, the mathematical language for that picture is this symmetry group, right? So there's a global symmetry and for the physical system, and there's a for the dynamics, and there's a in principle lower symmetry for the ground state. So for example, in the ferromagnet, the Ising symmetry is a spontaneous broken. A symmetry broken means this ground state symmetry is smaller than the or equal to the global symmetry. But then there is many recent progress telling us that this picture is not enough. So now we know this GH way to label phases is not enough. In fact, there are many phases that have the same G and H, but yet they're different. So this has been called a symmetry protected topological phases. And essentially, those phases are gapped quantum phases without topological order in the bulk. So the topological order essentially means no anion in the bulk in 2 plus 1D. The distinction between these phases are protected by symmetry. So essentially, in order to label or classify phases, you should not only use this G and H, there's some other label you have to consider. And how do I generally categorize these new orders? So all these phases actually have distinct gapless edge states. So you can use edge states as a probe to tell the difference. So theoretically, how do I see the difference? So how do I systematically describe them? There are different attempts, for example, for free fermion, there are this case theory by Pitayev, and also related work by Shensei and Ludwig and Schneider. For boson systems, this group cohomology methods by Xiechen, Gu, and Xiaogang, and Turner, Pullman, these people, seems to be a very useful theoretical framework. But let's don't forget that there's another part of gapped quantum spin liquid, gapped quantum phases that we know. So apart from this SPT phases, there's another piece of information we know for this new topological phases. So including fraction quantum Hall liquid and, for example, gapped quantum spin liquids. So in these phases, you have anions in the bulk, very different from this one. Over here, you in the bulk, the excitation is rather ordinary. But here, the bulk excitation is non-trivial. You contain this fractional statistical anions. And then you realize this, the stability of this anions or this topological order is very robust. You don't require any symmetry. You can break the symmetry as much as you want, but this phase still exists. So then the question is, how do I characterize this kind of new orders? This is not SPT. These are topological orders phase. So you can try to do some measurement. For example, in principle, you can measure this Anion statistics or topological ground state degeneracy on different topology of surface topology. And the theoretical free framework, there have been many different attempts, and they somehow have certain relation. People try to use gauge theory, tensor category, and the pattern of zero, for example. So from a serious point of view, so this part of phases look like this. So you have a gauge theory one, gauge theory two, and a different gauge theory, and a different maybe tensor categories. So this is what the, if you try to use a theoretical framework, this is what they look like. So then we have these two pieces of information. So this is what we know. At least this seem to be a very exciting new area. But then I think it's also important to realize that eventually the suppose we really try to describe physical systems, it's important to consider both symmetry and possible topological orders. So here I try to put these two pieces of information like two surfaces of our bulk of understanding. So it's on this surface, you assume no topological order. On the other surface, you assume no you don't require symmetry. But eventually we want to do this actually. So we want to look at phases possibly with both topological order and symmetry. So those are the phases with a symmetry but not topological order, and the other piece of information, they correspond to some special cases. Or another way to think about it is you can think about our physical system have certain projection. So it's suppose I have these phases with both symmetry and topological order, then suppose I only look at the symmetry part, I can think about there's some projection onto this plane. So I don't worry about this topological order. And then think about this topological order, I don't have to worry about the symmetry. So I can do this kind of projection. So this is what we eventually want to do. And so this is a phase of with both topological order and possibly with both topological order and symmetry. So the question is, do we have some systematic understanding over here in our bulk of understanding? So these phases have been called as symmetry enriched topological phases. So here I try to provide a partial, maybe only a small part of the answer for the big problem. So we try to classify not the most general symmetry enriched topological phases, but we consider some constraint. We consider a bosonic gap quantum phases into, for example, at this moment in 2+1D, and topological order with a topological that can be described by gauge group GG. And in the presence of a on-site global symmetry group SG. So here by on-site, what I really mean is you should think about this symmetry group as some local spin rotations, which don't move side to side. So they're not like a space group symmetry. So under this condition, we attempt to classify these phases by this third cohomology group by the cross product of SG and GG with coefficient in U1. So this is a mathematical object which I will explain maybe later, but not now. So at this moment, let me give you some example. So suppose my symmetry group is some isosymmetry, meaning the SG is Z2, and then my gauge group is Z2. And then I plug this into this formula, then I can compute it. Then this cohomology group becomes some Z2 cube. It's a finite abelian group. So what it means is in this classification, there will be eight Ising disordered phases with topological order that can be described by Z2 gauge group. So that's how to interpret this formula. And we provide exact soluble local bosonic model for each phase in this classification. And this model is a local bosonic, so the Tobler order would be all emergent. It's not. Yes. So I will come back to this in a moment. Yeah. It's a definition about this this mathematical object. So we can try to connect this this work with some previous works. So at least we can consider some very like sort of a simple limit. So when you don't have a Tobler order, meaning you should replace this gauge group by the trivial group, then maybe one should put I don't know, Z1 or something. Yeah, maybe Z1 is the most accurate way. So the so in this case, the physical question is, you know, we ask this physical question, you have both symmetry and Tobler order, but now you don't have Tobler order, so you only have symmetry. So in this case, the question is how many different kind of quantum phases in the presence of this global symmetry SG. So it turned out that Xie Chen and the collaborators, they show that these phases, which now they call symmetry-protected topological phases, are indeed classified by this SG, S3 of SG. So this is consistent with this result in the no-topological order limit. So we can consider another limit where this SG becomes trivial. So when you don't have symmetry, the symmetry group is the trivial group. So then in this case, the question underlying this classification is how many different topological orders that can be described by gauge group GG? Because you don't have symmetry, you only worry about topological orders. And it turned out that Dagmar Witten pointed out quite a long time ago that these different topological orders are also classified by the H3 of GG. So this is also consistent with this result in this no symmetry limit. So then the question is, what if I have both symmetry and the topological order? Both SG and GG are non-trivial. So when both of them are present, you immediately can have a physical intuition. So at least you can consider the following situation. The topological order and the global symmetry, they completely decouple. They don't even talk to each other. So for example, you can think about the bilayer system. Your topological order live on some second layer, categorized by some gauge group, and your global symmetry only act on the first layer, categorized by some symmetry group. And in this case, you immediately imagine that at least any reasonable classification should include the SPT phases living on the first layer and the different topological orders living on the second layer. So in fact, you can tune these two phases individually. So that means if you think a little bit further, you realize at least a classification should include the cross product of these two classifications. Right? So you can tune every index here and there individually. So that means suppose I have a classification, I better include all these classes. But in principle, the classification could contain more phases. The physical meaning of the more phases become clear. The reason is these phases have a simple picture. It means this symmetry and topology don't even talk to each other. The extra phase must mean some non-trivial interplay between the symmetry and topological order. The symmetry and topological, you cannot separate them. There's a certain, they're sort of entangled together. Right, so so let's also mention another piece of previous understanding. So what did we know about the symmetry in the topological order before? So in fact, there's a predicted symmetry group classification developed by Xiaogang. And it's a general framework trying to describe the so-called symmetry factorization phenomena. So this symmetry factorization is indeed a explicit sort of example about the interplay between the symmetry and topological order, how they interplay. So one way that they can interplay is through this so-called symmetry transformation. So the idea is that the quasi-particle and the symmetry transformation don't have to form a representation of the symmetry group, but they only need to form the projective representation. Like the super selection sector, maybe that's a super selection sector. It's a. It can be anything actually. It can be any topological excitation, right? So in principle, these quasi-particles don't have to form representation.
So here, right. Quasi-particle really means the excitation, which is not created by local spin flip, but something.
Topological defect. So there's a basic assumption behind the PSG classification about this interplay between symmetry and topological order. So that assumption is that you can always decouple a global symmetry transformation into a product of local transformations. And each local transformation only acts on one quasi-particle. So let me give an example. Imagine I have a quantum system with four quasi-particles. These quasi-particles are like some gauge flux, maybe, or gauge charge. So consider a global symmetry that transforms this state. The state have a symmetry, so like a U. You can use the symmetry to transform this whole state with four excited quasi-particles. So the assumption is I can find some local operator that only act around each quasi-particle, U1, U2, U3, U4, and then you multiply this local transformation. Then the consequence of this local transformation on this state is the same as the global symmetry transformation. So this is I think this assumption is the essence of a symmetry fractionalization. Basically, you can really fractionalize the symmetry. You can separate the effect of symmetry transformation on different quasi-particles locally. So I can give you an example about this symmetry fractionalization. So for example, let's think about a Z2 gauge theory. So the topological order is some Z2 gauge theory. So let's try to fractionalize, using this picture, let's try to fractionalize the Ising symmetry. So Ising symmetry means I have a generator whose square is 1, right? So, but let's imagine how this Ising symmetry can be fractionalized on the gauge charges. Because it's a gauge theory, the total gauge charge actually have to be even. So what I mean is, suppose I try to satisfy this condition when I fractionalize the global symmetry into these local symmetries. There are two possibilities. When I fractionalize the global symmetry locally, on a gauge charge, that local symmetry square can be either +1 or -1, because it doesn't matter. It don't change this final result, because even if you have say -1, but you have an even number of them, so when you multiply them together, it's the whole thing square is still 1. So this actually corresponds. I think this is maybe the simplest example about the non-trivial symmetry fractionalization. It's corresponding to the H2 of Z2 with coefficient in Z2. So this is the first Z2 is a symmetry group. The second Z2 corresponds to the gauge group. And if you compute this mathematical object, you got Z2. This Z2 corresponding to this plus minus sign. There are two possibilities. There are two different phases, actually. Right. Yes. Yeah, I will come back to that later. Sorry. Yeah, it's too mass. Yes. You at least you should consider more than one pairs, Because if you only create a single pair, it corresponding to one species of polyparticle with this antiparticle. At least you should consider many, many different possible pairs. Then the question is this enough? I don't think I have a counterexample. It could be enough, but I cannot prove this to you. Yeah. So the algebraic structure underlying this symmetry fractionalization or PSG is this H2 with coefficient of SG with coefficient in GG. So we assume GG to be abelian for simplicity. And we call it the symmetry fractionalization classes because it really tried to fractionalize the global symmetry. So what our classification contain? Our classification, there's a nice formula. This is called a Knuth formula. And so what this mathematical theorem tells you is you can simply expand this H3 of SG cross GG in terms of the cohomology group of this object themselves. So then you realize that there are these terms in the expansion, and every term have a pretty simple physical meaning, except for the last one. The first one is exactly this SPT phases, labeling the SPT phase. The second one, labeling different possible topological orders. The third one, labeling the different possible symmetry fractionalization classes. And there's some new term, which I haven't written down yet here. In these new phases, labeled by these new terms, we believe the notion of symmetry fractionalization simply fail. Question?
Yeah. So earlier, when you consider the symmetry on the charges rather than on the spins, right?
Uh-huh.
So
so in this particular case, both the symmetry group and the gauge group are Z2.
Right. But when you do the fractionalization, you're actually fractionalizing the gauge.
Fractionalizing the global symmetry.
But,
it's like
I
oh, that's right. So I'm fractionalizing the global symmetry on the gauge charges. That's maybe the more accurate way to say that. Mm-hmm. So these are red dots are gauge charges.
Right.
Yeah, but I'm fractionalizing this. this
I don't
yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So then you realize that these terms. Actually have as I mentioned, they have this meaning. So these indices, we have these indices even when the symmetry and topological order don't couple, right? So suppose I ignore those indices, so these indices will describe this completely decoupled system. The symmetry and topological order don't talk to each other, and these extra indices they are characterizing many different possible non-trivial interplays between the symmetry and topological order, and we know part of it seems to be related to symmetry fractionalization. Right. Right.
So one thing I don't understand well is in these pictures is the original diagram written classification is topological cohomology, so the space for the group.
Right. In this discrete, so let's think about discrete group for simplicity. In that case, I think that classifying space way to write group homology are the same, are exactly the same with this H3 of the gauge group. Yeah. So I think for continuous group, it become maybe more complicated. Yeah.
I think here one may have to stress this H is a group homology, not a topological homology.
Uh-huh.
So the classifying space for topological
homology. Mm. Right. So I will quickly mention the meaning of this mathematical object. Right. So in terms of my ideal picture, I think these are two indices. They're corresponding to this. So the H3 of SG corresponding to SPT. So they are indices mainly basically talking about this plane. And this H3 of TG, there are topological orders their indices on this plane. So suppose I don't look at those extra terms. If I only look at these two indices, it's like I can diagnose my quantum phases by projecting into these two planes. But this projection means something. It exactly means this interplay. So this interplay cannot be understood by this pictures on this plane. You have to go into the bulk to be able to see this extra structure. So this seems to at least, although I'm sure this classification is incomplete in many, many senses, but at least it contains this global picture, which I think at least very helpful for myself. Yeah.
Good question. So what if GG is non-abelian?
Yes. If GG is non-abelian, so this may remain the same.
Yeah.
So then you cannot write this term in this way. But there are other ways to write this term. That is okay. Because for group homology, this coefficient have to be a abelian group. But you can write it in terms of some torsion product and tensor product of group homology for SG and GG themselves. In a different way of writing it is okay.
And it's also maybe simpler way that you replace GG by H1 of GG.
Uh-huh.
And I think it would work.
Mm-hmm. Right,
sir. So, two questions. The first question, so do you know for sure that all of these are different things?
I'm sure they're not all different phases. What I'm sure is this, for example, let me give a simple example. A Dirac-Witten classification certainly is overcomplete. Meaning you can, suppose I have a Z2 cross Z2 gauge group. You can use this Dirac-Witten to twist the gauge theory in either one of the Z2. So you can twist, for example, you can twist this Z2 gauge theory into the so-called double Samian theory. So the double Samian theory is, and this Z2 is a Euro, the top-level order. And in kinematic language, it's called the toric top-level order. So you can use the group homology to twist the gauge theory in this way. Or you can twist the gauge theory in the opposite way. So this is double Samian. And this is a toric code. In terms of Dirac-Witten, these two different kind of twists correspond to different group homology element. So, but physically, there's the same phase. Right? So it's just a different way of labeling your body particle. So it's overcompleted, at least in this sense.
Minus one
label. You have to mod out this to. Yes.
Usually the global symmetries both have to gauge symmetries, right? When I define the action of the global symmetry on the system, I can have them close up to gauge symmetry.
The
relation, so the global symmetry group only need to hold up to gauge symmetry.
Uh-huh.
So I might wonder would it be possible to replace the product with the semi-direct product?
Yeah, that's I think that's related to Xiaogang's generalization. They have some generalization for this classification to include other possible group extensions.
Okay.
Yeah. So then there are many different possible group extensions, and each group extension should have its own physical meaning. And I think maybe Xiaogang have some general understanding. But I think at least for this sort of trivial group extension, I understand the physics quite well. So maybe we should.
Are there local models that we can down for the group extensions as well?
Yeah, I think so. There's no trouble of doing that. Okay. So our classification, why is it reasonable? I can mention something. So there's a nice work by Levin and Gu earlier, last year. So they point out there's some underlying relation between the SPT phase and Dirac-Witten phases. based on this group and global symmetry duality. So our work is a natural generalization of Levin and Goose work by only partially dualize the gauge group of the Dirac Witten total order. So essentially, the idea of their work is suppose I have SPT phases by characterized by global symmetry G. We know it's classified by the H3 of G with coefficient U1. And if I have a Dirac Witten phase with gauge group G, it's also seem to be classified by the same mathematical object. So same mathematical objects show up in two different contexts. So there's certain, there's probably some underlying relation. So what they point out is you can just gauge the global symmetry, or you dualize the gauge group back to global symmetry. You can do this to the trick and to see the underlying relation. So what we do here is it's quite a natural generalization. You have two groups, SG and GG. You only dualize one of them, and that's the idea. So I think let me quickly mention the mathematical meaning for this object, the H3 of G with coefficient U1. So the mathematical meaning for this circumhomology group is the following. So for every element, it's called a spherical cycle in the spherical homology group, it defines a function or a mapping that maps three group elements to a U1 phase. So here is where the phase, this coefficient shows up. If I have a Z2 here, I should replace this U1 by Z2. It will be a group function mapping into Z2. But here is a mapping into U1. So this mapping have to satisfy certain condition. I don't want to list those conditions, just remember that not all group functions are co-cycle. You have to satisfy some condition. So the mathematical foundation for our exact-solvable models is this Dirac-Witten topological invariant for n-manifold. So this mathematical theorem I can describe in two parts. So essentially, the first theorem is about closed manifold. So let's think about the closed three manifold as an example. So the Dirac-Witten tells you that there's a way to compute a topological invariant for this three manifold, closed three manifold. So the idea is let's firstly choose a spherical cycle. Then for any closed manifold, I do the following procedure. I triangulate the three manifold by this tetrahedron. And then for each tetrahedron, I do this so-called ordering procedure. I basically means I assign arrows on these bounds by choosing a particular order of the vertices. So the arrow always go from smaller to bigger vertices. So I have this ordering, and then I do this so-called coloring. Coloring means I can assign group elements on these bounds. And this assignment is I should assign group element for every bound. But this assignment is not arbitrary. It has to satisfy this so-called zero flux constraint. So that means, suppose I have a phase of the tetrahedron, then the product of the two group element equal the third group element. So there are certain constraint. So you cannot arbitrarily assign this group element. So it's like you know two, you know the third one. So then every group assignment satisfy this rule is called a coloring. So, but there are many, many possible colorings that you can do for this triangulation. But for fixed coloring, you assign a phase, this U1 phase, to the colored tetrahedron. You can basically show that although there are six bonds for the tetrahedron, by this rule, there are only three of them are independent. And then you basically write these three independent group element and compute this phase by this omega, this spherical cycle. Then this complex number is associated with this geometrical object, which is a tetrahedron. So then you can do this for every single tetrahedron and for every coloring. So the Dirac-Witten invariance is defined to be the product of all faces for all the tetrahedron. So for each tetrahedron, there's a face, you make a product of all these faces. And then you sum over all possible coloring, because for each fixed coloring, you can compute this product. But then you sum over all possible coloring. Then you divide by some normalization factor. So what is surprising by Dr. Witten is that this invariant is independent of the triangulation and of the ordering. Because you already sum over all possible colorings. So this certainly will be independent of coloring. But naively, it will depend on this triangulation and ordering. But the theorem tells you it don't depend on those. So it's only depend on the manifold topology and the spherical cycle. And so this is the theorem one for closed manifold. There is a theorem two for open manifold. So let's think about the, so in fact, this is true for any N group cohomology group. So, but let's think about third cohomology, group cohomology. Let's think about the open three manifold. So what is Dr. Witten's theorem tells you that is that you can do the following for open manifold. You choose a spherical cycle. Then for any open manifold, you firstly triangulate and then order and color the surface. So you fix the triangulation and the ordering and the coloring, the group element assignment on the surface. And then you fix them. Then you extend this triangulation, ordering, coloring into the bulk. So the bulk triangulation, ordering, coloring have to be compatible with the surface. But even I require them to be compatible, there are still many, many possible bulk triangulation and possible ordering and colorings. Right? So then what the theorem tells you is that you can compute the summation of all possible colorings and product of all these phases for every tetrahedron. Then the claim is it's independent of the triangulation and ordering in the bulk. It only depends on surface. So it only depends on the manifold topology and the spherical cycle and the surface, triangulation, ordering, coloring. So these two theorems are the foundation of our model. So this is related to topological quantum field theory, which I don't have time to talk about. So maybe I should skip this. So let me mention the model. The model looks like this. This Hamiltonian can be written as a summation of local terms, and so it acts on some Hilbert space. The Hilbert space, let's choose triangle lattice, is defined in the following way. So for the Hilbert space is spanned by the spin states on the bound that belong to the gauge group. So for every bound, there's a degree of freedom whose possible quantum states are labeled by the gauge group. Suppose your gauge group is Z2, that means there's a spin 1/2 on the bound. And for you have this degree of freedom for every bound. So this Hamiltonian is a local Hamiltonian acting on this Hilbert space, spanned by those local degree of freedom. And this QT is a local term that basically a projector enforcing this zero flux rule. So if the state don't satisfy the local flux rule, when you act on QT, it gives you zero. If it's satisfied, it gives you one. So then this term favors this zero flux rule. And the second term contains both QT and some other term. This BP is another term. The political meaning is it's enforcing some enforcing the no gate charge rule for this surface for this triangle lattice. So what does BP look like is the following: it's a summation of many many terms, and each term corresponding to a group element S in the group. And the meaning for this BPS is pretty simple. What it means is it flips all these bounds connecting a single vertex by the same group element S. So the idea is this. So this is a geometrical interpretation for this BPS term. You start from a quantum state with some coloring on this honeycomb, and then you make a S group element, then you so all this group element on this original bond got flipped by into this blue bond, and the blue bond group element you can compute from the original element by this zero flux rule for the vertical triangle. So that's the idea. So then it's pretty obvious that QT mutually commute, and QT and BP also commute, because this kind of flipping of spin by same group element don't change the zero flux rule, so they certainly should commute. What is not obvious is to show that different BP also commute. So the idea is I want to show every term in the Hamiltonian, they mutually commute. They're like mutually commutative projectors. So that's why the model is exhaustible. So BP mutual commute is actually a direct consequence of theorem two. So the different way of multiplying BP corresponding to this different geometrical object. So if I multiply this BP on this vertex first, then on that vertex later, what happens is the bond are flipped in this geometrical way. So there's some internal bond in this along this direction. If I multiply them, this BP first, the other BP later, then they correspond to a different geometrical object. I flip this bond first, then I flip it further higher. But then the theorem tells you that these two quantum amplitude are equal. They don't depend on the internal triangulation. So this bond this way or that way corresponds to internal triangulation. So the geometric theorem tells you that they mutually commute. So this is why the model is solvable. In addition, if you ask what's a ground state, you actually know what a ground state look like. The ground state, because they mutually commute, the ground state must be the image of the product of all these projectors. So that means the image of product, all the product means in those states, all the QT equal one, all the BP equal one. So that's the ground state. And the product of all this projector, you can try to make the product of all these projectors. So eventually, you think about this, right? So you multiply two. What eventually happens is you flip bond on these bonds, but on the bond connecting these two, it simply lifts it up, and you can keep making product. Eventually, you lift all the bond up, so the geometric interpretation for the product of all the projectors become this lifting the triangle lattice up by step, and it's exactly this related to this Degrow-Witten TQFT ground state sector. So. And let me spend some time. Here I mentioned that how do I visualize the ground state, right? But we know that we should also be able to solve the excited state, which is very important because I want to understand how the symmetry, eventually the symmetry and the excited state interplay, right? So the question, how do I look at the excited state? So it may be helpful to recall what we learned from the Torrey code model. In fact, if I choose G equals Z2, and if I choose a trivial cycle means the group function equals one always for all three group elements. So it's a trivial cycle. The phase is trivial, always trivial. And in this case, you can show this model goes back to this Torrey code model. You can write this term that I mentioned earlier in terms of the more conventional term. So this QT become a summation of one half, like one plus the product of QZ around a triangle. So that it makes sure the zero flux rule. And this BP is a term flipping all the six spins. It's actually two terms. One is its identity, another is flipping all the spins. You can think about translate it into this more conventional like a honeycomb lattice Torrey code model. So this is acting on the vertex, and this is on the plaquette flipping the six bond. And so let's recall how do we construct excitation for Torrey code. It's actually what we do is the following. We firstly make a product of all this, for example, the spin flipping operator over a finite region. So then if you make a product over a region, that means on the boundary, so in the middle, all the spins are flipped twice. So they are not flipped. But on the boundary, you flip some spin. But this flip spin on the boundary, they form a loop. So then the idea is I can cut this loop into an open string. Then the end of the string give you the quasi-particle excitation. So that's how people solve the toric code model. So here we can do something similar. We also can make a product for example, the BP operator, actually BPS operator over a finite region. And in the middle, all the spins are flipped twice, so they don't flip. And only this boundary spin got flipped. But there's some more subtlety because when the cocycle is non-trivial, you have phase contribution within the disk. But then you have to show it's a boundary term and so on. So let me don't go into too much detail. But essentially, you still can do this trick. You firstly make a loop by the boundary of the disk, and then you cut this loop into open string. But it's physically is more general, actually. You should call it a ribbon operator, because clearly on the boundary, there's an inner and there's an outer edge. This inner outer edge are physically different. And you can represent this ribbon in this simple geometrical way. And at the end of a ribbon, you create a quasi-particle excitation. This is how you create quasi-particle excitation and study them. And you can study the property of these quasi-particle excitations by constructing some local operator. And this local operator are acting on this end or that end. It's only acting on the end. It directly transforms the quasi-particle excitation. And they form a nice so-called twisted extended ribbon algebra. It's a generalization of Kitaev ribbon algebra without twist. So you can study the local property of these quasi-particle excitations. And the topological order of this phase are characterized, of course, by the braiding and the fusion of the quasi-particles created at the end of the ribbon. And how do I study this braiding and fusion properties of these quasi-particles? Just one second. So I can use this ribbon operator, and I can really braid them. And I can also really fuse them. So eventually, the message is all these properties of braiding and fusion can be understood algebraically by this ribbon algebra question.
So earlier the B operator is kind of on the hexagonal plane. So what breaks the symmetry that you only have on the triangles half now?
Sorry, say it again.
Like your thing was originally on a hexagon,
uh-huh.
Like these, and if you put a bunch of them together, I was thinking there's a inner edge, but then there will be like if I were just thinking of the symmetry there. Then there are two outer edges, but in this written
cool.
picture, you only get one
white
edge, one red edge. So
what happens? It's
either
only actually one outer edge. You, the way you think about it is, say, think about this, right? There's a product of two BP operator. Let's say I keep here, you can think about keep doing that for a region. So then there's the outer edge. Only one outer edge and one inner edge.
Maybe I can ask later.
Yeah, maybe you can talk later. Yeah, so you can understand this braiding fusion or the topological order completely by this algebra. By the end of the day, you can show this topological order are described by the so-called quasi-quantum double. And I can give you an interesting example. If I choose a gate group as a Z2 cube, there's 3 Z2, then I can choose a twist, a cocycle, so that the quasi-quantum double, or the topological order of this model, is equals some D4 nanobillion gate theory. So this was firstly pointed out by Bison and collaborators. And so this is the algebra, what the algebra look like. Yeah. So finally, let me mention how do I add symmetry. Adding symmetry is another quite simple step. So with let's think about your G have two ingredients, SG and GG. Then firstly, let's treat this G as a gauge group. Then we can construct all possible derivative models. But then for every derivative model, I can do this following trick. I can dualize the SG degree of freedom from the bound to the site. So the idea is for every bound degree of freedom, I can think about them corresponding to two contribution. There's a GG group element living on the bound, but the SG group element living on the site, on this I and J site, and it contributes to the SG part of the GIJ. So the model looks the same, actually. But you just keep in mind that this bound variable, the SG part of the bound variable coming from the site. And then you can, now this model have a global symmetry SG. And you still can use ribbon to create cobordic excitations. But you certainly know, because you know the global symmetry, you know how an excited state transform under a symmetry group. And then you can, for example, use this twisted ribbon algebra to study how symmetry got fractionalized on this end of ribbon or quadriparticle excitations. So what you find is the gauge charge always have a trivial symmetry fractionalization, but the gauge flux have non-trivial gauge symmetry fractionalization. So let me mention, I think I'm running out of time. Yeah, so maybe let me mention one example, which is this example. So let's think about SG and the GG. The GG is a Z2 cross Z2, and SG is Z2. So let me focus on this particular example. So then when you compute the H3 of SG cross GG, you find the result is Z2 seventh power. So there are a lot of phases. And then you follow the expansion. Then you find that among this Z2 seventh power, there's a one Z2 from the SPT index and a Z2 cube from the Dagger-Witten index. And there's a Z2 square for the symmetry fractionalization. And there's some extra term. The extra term actually becomes Z2, which is non-trivial. So the Z2 square, the physical meaning for this means that we can think about the Vison, the two Z2 group. So there are two possible gauge flux excitations. When I fractionalize my symmetry group on sector one or sector two, I find the Ising square can be plus minus one here for sector one and also plus minus here for sector two. So then that means there are two Z2. And this two Z2 is exactly the Z2 square. And let's finally look at the extra term. The extra term is some weird torsion product. And we believe there's a new phase beyond symmetry fractionalization. Let me just mention what they mean. We can choose a cocycle among this expansion to make this non-trivial. And then we can ask how the Ising symmetry is acting on quadriparticles. You realize the Ising symmetry is interchanging quadriparticle species in some way. And this E1, M1 are labeling the gauge charge and gauge flux in the two Z2 sector. And this can never be realized by symmetry fractionalization because it violates this basic assumption. Because you can never interchange quadriparticle species by local operator. And there's one measurable consequence. You can consider a single pair of Vison. Then you can show that the Ising symmetry protects the twofold degeneracy. So this is rather weird, right? Because you have a two quadriparticle and twofold degeneracy. So this twofold degeneracy cannot be locally associated with any quadriparticle. It has to be there because of global entanglement, right? So finally, this classification can be generalized to higher dimension. For example, surpass 1D, you consider H4 of SD cross DG. Here, the interesting thing is there's new kind of interplay between symmetry and some excited excitation, like the flux loops. So this is not well understood yet, at least for myself. So, and there are also this Hong and Xiaogang's generalization by replacing the cross product by any possible group extension. And the missing symmetry fractionalization for gauge charge are captured by this generalization, actually. And finally, I talk about some detectable signature like symmetric protected excited states, degeneracy. But the most general way to measure symmetry in enriched topological orders, I didn't mention. But these ESLov models actually become very useful tools. Let me acknowledge my postdoc, who is very hardworking and the driving force behind this project and the funding agency. And thank you.
So I have some suspicion that even for symmetry group and CH group, there is more beyond this either of your classification. So because if you look at this GS extension of the category GG graded vector space, then actually an example, I think for a GS equals Z mod 2Z and the other one being some of the something relatively simple. There's something that you cannot write. So the simple objects in that category, that extension category, cannot be written as, you know, one element from one group and one element from the other group. Because everything that you do, right, Xiaogang, even your thing, because the cosine will be based on the fact that these vertices have labels, which is one group element from each. But in this case, I think there's simple objects which don't take that form.
Maybe let me try to guess what you mean. So let's think about the Z2 topological order. Let's think about toric code. And in this Z2 topological order, you have four quasi particles, like identity, E, M, and E, M, right? So I think it's possible for Ising symmetry doing the following. It's interchange this E and M. Because the interchanging E and M don't change the fusion braiding algebra. So this allows the symmetry interplay with topological order. So this is allowed, but it's not captured here.
Not even in the
Xiaogang
simulation. So what is you have something like
yeah,
this.
Yeah, I have something like this, but it's a Z2 cross Z2.
Yeah, but can you just describe in this language what kind of a...
Right, that's
slash pretty quickly, so
yeah.
I don't see.
Yeah, it's like this. It's one, but because you know there are many. This is not a completely physical. It's just one language, because you can label these two Z2 quasi particles in many different ways.
Okay.
But if you choose one, fix one convention. There's a E1, M1, E2, M2. Then you realize this Ising is sending your electric charge to electric charge plus. So this is new electric charge. This is new E1. This is new M1. New E2, new M2.
So
everybody
is
Z2.
So electric charge bound with a flux of a next gate field, beyond
yeah,
gate
yeah. But if you choose a different convention, then this becomes, so this is the most natural convention you choose by the model. But there's a different convention you choose, that this simply means E1, M2, E2, M2 goes to E2, M2, E1, M1.
Just the exchange.
So that's why I think this kind of phenomena is reasonable to show up here, because you know this classification appears in any dimension, right? In any spatial dimension.
So this kind of change do not change the group gauge group structure.
Yeah.
This change probably break the gauge group structure.
No, so in higher dimension, E is a point, M is a loop.
Oh, I see.
There's no way to do this in higher dimension.
I see. So you're saying this may be special for
two plus one. Yeah, that's why
this may appear in any dimension.
Yeah. I think that's a bottom line. So I think that's a physical reason why it's missing what you're talking about. Because I think what you talk about is specific in 2+1D. Question.
So in order to build these line defects, these particles, you first build a Hamiltonian which produces like a victim, and then look at the excitation of this Hamiltonian. In principle, I guess you could have tried to define this line defects directly in like a victim.
You mean directly in dark orbit?
Right.
Yeah.
Do you think
there is
an advantage in going for the Hamiltonian?
Because right. So Yeah, I think maybe we're talking about the same thing. So I think this is already quite close to what you're talking about. You use this ribbon, right? So it's I think this, I don't know what, maybe you're thinking about the, in the ground state sector, you're changing the different ground state sector.
No, you local modification of ground state,
uh-huh.
is article in space-time,
right.
line in space-time.
Right.
But in principle, it's the space-time diagram with that bitten. And then it's article would be a modification of the rules, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I see. I think you are thinking about Lagrangian, essentially, right? I think that's I think that is, now I quite clearly understand. I think that's also very useful, actually. I think this probably can be done in that way as well. Yeah. Right. I think it's depend on the taste. I think it's I think physics probably will be the same. Maybe. Yeah, I think here essentially, you know, condensed matter people like Hamiltonian more.
Other questions?
Yeah, if not, I'll send in again.